What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. And we're rolling. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hey, guys. As always, I'm Varun. I am the co-host of the Polititeen podcast, hosted by myself and my high school friend, Damien, here today. And the Polititeen podcast is mainly trying to spread information about political initiatives just to create education and awareness for young voters and young activists across the nation to create political conversation and discussion in the biggest topics in this year. So Damien, I would like to jump into our podcast immediately. You know, today for today's plan, we have Representative Brenda Lopez Romero, a former candidate for Congress from District 7 in Georgia, jumping on the podcast. Before that, I wanted to kind of mention what we talked about for a long time after the interview with Dr. Lester on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was the cancel culture. Both of us talked about it kind of profusely after on our own independent segments. So I wanted to kind of mention that topic again. So, Damien, how do you feel about cancel culture in the United States and beyond?
Well, I was having an interesting discussion because obviously, you know, we've had our own personal relations with cancel culture. You know, we can discuss that later in the podcast, but I was having a discussion and it's interesting because, you know, you look at it and you see, you know, would you deny someone in the KKK from joining Black Lives Matter or someone that was formerly in the KKK from joining Black Lives Matter? And it's an interesting perspective. I think that it would take more trust to get that person to join. But it's just it's a complex situation. But I think that cancel culture as a whole has become so toxic. And the reason being, and I brought this up, I was discussing cancel culture with someone and I said, part of creating change in America is you have to fess up, you have to confess to where you've been wrong as a human. And I think that if we're all so worried about admitting, you know, I would be hypocritical in telling people to not say insensitive, to not make insensitive jokes when I myself have made insensitive jokes. So I have to hear on the podcast say, hey guys, hey listeners, I may attack people that make insensitive jokes. I may say that it's wrong, but in my past, I've made insensitive jokes. So I'm going to fess up so that I can show you the truth and the actual meaning of you know, not being a hypocrite. But in doing so, I can also harm myself. It's a very odd situation. And I said this, and I think that this is powerful towards the situation. I think that that's why when you make your confessions, you make them in a box behind a screen.
Yeah. And I think that with what you're saying, people who are going out to people and saying, don't say these kinds of terms and this terminology and these derogatory words don't have as much of an impact as people who are saying, you know, I've said this and I've grew from it. You know, I used to be you, you know, I was in your shoes and now I'm not. You know, it means a lot more from somebody who understands the situation and knows that, you know, and can kind of roll back on their experience to kind of tell somebody that there's a way to get past it. With some circumstances individually, I've seen that people telling me something may seem egotistical, may seem like they're kind of bolstering themselves, bolstering their ego, feeding into that ego. But if you're talking about, I used to do this and I've grown from it and now I want you to grow from it, it's more than, you know, boosting your ego. It's actually trying to do a good thing for the world. And I think that with what you're saying, it's 100% right. I 1000% agree, because cancel culture has come to a point where we can't even be humans anymore. And we've talked about humanity, our humanity, and everybody's humanity over the past couple of episodes. Everybody's human. You know, most specifically, every single congressman, every single representative, every single one of our nation's leaders is a human, and they've made mistakes. And part of what makes the Polititeen podcast what it is because we're able to acknowledge our nation's mistakes. So if we, like I told you on the last podcast, if we can't forgive our nation for the mistakes that we've made and work forward towards it, then we might as well shun our own nation. You know, are we gonna cancel the United States of America for war crimes?
Yeah. Yeah, no. And it's interesting too, because I think part of progressing forward as a nation, and you know, you can say that on terms of racial tensions, especially, it's admitting the fact that, hey, we had slaves for X amount of years. We had Jim Crow law for X amount of years. We do commit acts of brutality against African Americans at a disproportionate rate. And you can't say, oh, so you guys admitted it. Haha, now I'm going to move to Canada. It's like, no, okay, so how can we make the steps forward to make, you know, ourselves a better nation? I don't think that we should be in an environment, and I think that it's a very toxic environment. If you can't admit your wrongdoing, and without the fear of being canceled, because the thing is, a lot of people don't know. Like, if I were to tell someone, I can't think of anything on the spot, but if I were to tell the podcast something that I did wrong, there's a chance that 90% of the listeners, unless they're my friends or someone that I speak to personally, that they won't know. They wouldn't have known about this circumstance beforehand. So should I suffer the repercussions of telling them, of telling the listeners, hey, this is my personal experience with the situation. I know I was wrong in the past, but this is how I made changes forward. Or should I just shut up, you know, and not mention it and not talk about it?
Yeah, I think that what you mentioned kind of brings me back to a point that I've been trying to make clear over the past couple of days and past couple of episodes to friends, to peers. I think that canceling a person for their past actions, no matter how long ago it was, makes them scared to become a better person.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is if you tell a person that he's a terrible person, an evil person for what he did before, no matter if he's a member of the KKK, like you're saying, no matter what he's done, there's no room for change. You're kind of inhibiting his ability to change, his or her ability to change from what his past was like. But I think that if you give him a new future, a new vision of what his future can be, then you can inspire him to change. And we talk about, I forget the guy's name. I always forget his name. The person that we're going to have on the podcast, Damien, who taught the KKK members to become better people. Do you remember his name?
Yeah, Daryl Davis, I believe.
Daryl Davis. Right. So if Daryl Davis told the KKK people that, you know, he canceled them, he was like, you're terrible people and you can never change from where you're at right now, they would have never changed. And he might have got killed in the action. What he did was he said that, you know, I see your flaws, and he took a very, very systemic approach to changing those things. He made jokes towards them. He became friends with them. And that's the way to advance a person's cause, is understanding exactly why they're the way that they are and attacking that root instead of attacking who they are and saying there's no room for change.
Yeah, and something that I think ties directly into, you know, this modern day cancel culture, and I think that it's kind of funny that we're trying to cancel culture. I think that cancel culture can make steps itself as a kind of as a kind of movement, I suppose. That's how you would word it. It's a movement. I think that it can make its changes itself as a movement to better itself, and that we should accept the new cancel culture. But something that ties directly into cancel culture is woke culture. And I want to know your perspective on it. What do you think about being woke?
I think that woke culture and cancel culture kind of tie in together in some circumstances. And hear me out when I say this. Woke culture, I think from my perspective and my experiences, has the kind of thing of somebody or a group of people trying to say that I am woke and going to any means to prove that they are broke. And that may mean that they cancel other people upon no basis or talking to them. So I think that woke culture is actually more diminutive and even more powerful than cancel culture, because it's people doing whatever they can to seem woke and to feed into their ego.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's the funniest thing about woke culture. It's like so narcissistic to be like, I'm woke. Yeah, it's like, it's such a weird statement. But I didn't have an issue with woke culture, I think, 4 years ago or 5 years ago. I think that woke culture in itself now has become elitist, if you get what I'm saying. Like, you have to be the top of the top, like, creme de la creme human in order to be considered woke. Like, it's weird because I think that a lot of people, as a matter of fact, would consider me and you woke. I think that they would consider this, you know, deem it a woke podcast. Yeah. Not what we're shooting for at all. I don't think shooting to be woke by any means. But I think that that it's interesting that some people would consider us woke and then other people would also cancel us. It's so, it's such a weird, and it's the same, yeah. It's the same group. It's the same group that would consider us woke, but we're not woke enough. So if you're not woke enough, you have to be canceled. You either have to be like an extreme woke person or you're canceled. You're done.
I don't know who makes the rules, Damien. I have no idea who makes these rules, but there's some higher authority who I don't know who it is, but they make the rules on who's woke and who's not. And it's diminutive. You know, it's almost like you're bullying a person out of being who they are by saying, hey, you're woke and hey, you're not.
Yeah.
Almost like you're saying discriminating against somebody who's not woke and being like, if you make one mistake in your life, then you're not woke and you're not part of our elitist group. It's like a clique. You know, it's like a clique which spans thousands of people across our nation. And I mean, on one hand, it's a good thing to see people, young people especially, being woke and being politically involved. But there's a huge difference between being politically involved and being woke. And right now, I think that what you were saying about woke is right. A couple of years ago, I could know what that word meant, and I respected that word. But right now, there's so many different meanings of that word and so many different takes upon woke culture that I don't really know what I'm facing.
You know, and I think something that's interesting is that I think the Democratic platform has done it more so, but I think that both platforms are kind of establishing their own means of woke, and this elitist ideology is kind of forming within both platforms. So take a second here. I think that if you don't check every box under the perfect Democrat, that the Democrat, you know, the Democratic Party will never push you. You have to be the perfect Democrat. And it's something interesting. Because we, you know, I wasn't thinking about this earlier, but we were talking about how a lot of the people that we have on are typically progressive Democrats, and they kind of check all the same boxes in terms of their platform. So something interesting here, and something that I've never really considered, is the fact that, you know, Bernie Sanders kind of strayed away from that. Bernie Sanders scares the kind of the Democratic basis because of the fact that, he doesn't really check all of the boxes. He checks more boxes than he needs to. And it's interesting because you have to, like, to be considered a Democrat now, you have to be against abortion. You have to be against Donald Trump. You have to be pro-immigration. You have to be, not against abortion, against not having abortions, because I think I said against abortion. You have to be pro-choice. That's what I'm trying to say. You have to be pro-choice, you know, pro-immigration. You have to follow this basis of platform. And if you don't check one of the boxes, then you're done. And it's interesting because I think Trump has done the same thing to the Republican Party. If you don't, you know, support Trump, then I think that's the only box that you really have to check to be a Republican. It's like, support Trump, anything that he does blindly, and you're good. So I think that it's interesting to see how woke culture, I think, has played a role in developing what really is a Democrat and what really is a Republican. And it's become elitist.
I think that what you're saying is 1,000% right, because talking about the candidates that we've had on the podcast, Damien, a lot of them come from backgrounds in which, you know, they I'm trying to retrace my mind here, but they fit the mold of being a progressive Democrat, or being that kind of progressive candidate. But once they jump on our podcast, I think the questions that we ask them make it so, you know, they're more open to other ideas, and the ideas that they've had in their mind, preconceived notions, come out and show themselves a full force. So I think that us bringing out and kind of bringing out those ideas within them is something that we need in our nation, because we need politicians to be transparent about every single one of their plans for our state and our local communities. Because, you know, it's one thing to be fit the mold of a Democrat and to run on that policy and then go into office and pull out different policies out of the back of your mind, out of a hat per se, and it would screw up the voters and how they voted for you. I think the politicians need to be more transparent about the policies, no matter if it loses in the election or wins in the election. And honestly, I think that if they do that, we'll have a lot of diversity in political policies that are presented on a nationwide level. You know, we talk about Bernie setting a statement and setting himself apart from the Democratic Party. And in that circumstance, the Democratic establishment, they looked away from Bernie. They were like, Bernie is too radical for us. He's too left wing for us. But the Republican Party, when they saw somebody with the amount of right-wing caliber as Donald Trump did, instead of looking away from him and saying that they didn't have the same views as him, they instead changed their views, if you hear what I'm saying, to coagulate with what he was.
Yeah.
So right now, I don't know. I honestly do not know what the Republican policy is right now. I used to know it very clearly. When Mitt Romney ran, when John McCain ran for president, I respected their policies and I agree with a lot of them. I knew exactly what they ran for. Right now, I can name a couple of policies out of the top of my mind. You know, they don't like abortions. Sometimes
they don't like abortions.
And honestly, right now, if Trump supported abortions, I think they would support abortions as well. I think that whatever he does is the law of the land right now. It's more of a Trump party than the Republican party right now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think something interesting, you know, you were bringing up the whole politicians, you know, being more transparent. I think that a good thing about the podcast, and I think that the reason that we've, you know, not to toot our own horn, but the reason that we've seen an incline in success and we've seen kind of, you know, I really enjoy doing the podcast is because no diss to the candidates, but, you know, when you think of politicians, you think of a politician. And I think that when you get to see like the more human side of them and be like, oh, I think Ted Terry is the perfect example. I think that Ted is such a likable person because of the fact that he shows who he really is. And he's not just – and I think that it's very interesting to see when someone hops on the podcast and you talk to them, they're not a politician. They're just, you know, it's just Ted Terry. It's not Mayor Ted. It's not Mayor Terry. It's just Ted Terry, and you have the same with all of these interesting candidates. And I think that that's really good, and I think that it's something that America is missing right now. The fact that we can just talk as people. I just love it. I love being able to see the human side, the normal side of a politician.
Yeah, you talk about Ted and his policies, and I've always respected Ted Terry for the amount of transparency that he shows. You know, on the podcast, one of the main things that he said to us in talking to us was that transparency was one of his main goals as DeKalb County Commissioner, because everything that he said was very different from the Democratic mold. You know, he was not the average Democrat with the average policies and the general policies. No. And I think that him and Natalie Buxko and Krista Olenzak and Charles Ravenscraft, every single one of our candidates have showed us on the podcast that they're not the average Democrat. But Ted Terry has gone out on social media, especially him and his website, and been bold enough to show that to voters instead of just the podcast. So I think with some candidates, it's been us bringing it out within them. But with Ted Terry, it's been him showing it to voters because that's what sets him apart. You know, I had the pleasure and privilege of seeing him speak to Forsyth County Democratic Party at a potluck dinner that we had a couple of months ago. I think it was last year, December. But he spoke to the entire place, the entire convention. And what he said was so different from what the other candidates had to say that, you know, there was crowds around him. You know, and there was people coming to meet him and just to discuss the policies that he'd said, because other candidates who were there that day, no disrespect to them, but the policies that they had were something that we've heard for so long and I don't have any questions about. But if you're talking about policies that somebody hasn't talked about, it's going to raise important questions and that's going to raise political discussion. And I think for candidates to win elections locally and nationally, I think they have to raise political discussion, because if you look at who has won the past 2 years, it has been the past two elections. Donald Trump raised political discussion. I don't care in which way he raised it, but the news channels were covering him 24/7. Yeah. President Obama raised political discussion about the recession, and even him being an African-American candidate, that raised political discussion. So I think that raising that discussion is integral for any candidate to win and not fitting that mold.
Well, if we want to talk about winning, and we want to talk about damn winning, then we can't not mention our guest that is about to come on. You know, Representative Romero, she won twice with 100% of the vote. And that's not in the primaries. That's in her, you know, election.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very impressive. And I think that the reason that she has won in this manner is because of the fact that she's so transparent. She you know, she's so likable. She's so personable. And I mentioned to you before on the podcast. I don't know why, but it might be, you know, this sounds weird.
Yeah.
But the way her face, like her, I don't know. It just something feels different. Her demeanor, like she seems so friendly, if you get what I'm saying.
She seems very personable. You know, I had the pleasure of, again, talking to her with the Forsyth Democratic Party a couple of months ago. At the same time as I talked to Ted, and she embodied a kind of more personal approach to who she was. You know, I almost felt like I could trust her with things because of the way she spoke and the way that she positioned herself. Her whole campaign, I believe, and the way she speaks is for the people. You know, everything is for the people and for Georgia. But more importantly, she positions herself as a person who is likable and a person who you'd be friends with and want to talk about with policy. So I talk about so much about how we need to spark political discussion as candidates and as individuals. But part of that thing, part of that push comes down to being a likable person.
Yeah.
And also being comfortable talking and having these political discussions, because you can spark them all right. But once they come to you, what are you going to do with it? And I think that once they come to Representative Lopez Romero, she has the ability and the speaking ability to tackle these hard conversations. And that's why she's won so long. And so, you know, the breadth of how she's won has been so impressive.
Yeah, no. And, you know, I think I also wanted to mention this earlier, because we were talking about, you know, all the candidates that we've had on, and something that really sucks and something that's hard. And we talk about the Trump Party, you know, the Republican Party. Something that's difficult, something that's difficult to see is that right now we aren't against Republican ideals. I consider myself a centrist, and I really do believe that. But I would not consider myself in any means a centrist in terms of today's climate. And I want to make that completely clear, because right now I'm not, you know, it's not a discussion of abortion against, you know, I'm always listening. I'm always able to listen to that. Abortion or pro-life versus pro-choice. I've always been able to listen to that discussion. But right now it's just such a weird discussion where you're not arguing with ideals and how ideals can change and stuff. You're just arguing with Donald Trump, and every person is just imitating kind of Donald Trump's policies and whatever they think. I feel like when you're having a discussion with Republicans, with Republican candidates, it's kind of they're thinking of what Trump would like them to say. And that's difficult. But beyond being difficult, I want to have more Republican candidates, but it also feels like they're very hard to reach out to.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like a difficulty is the fact that we're young with Republican candidates. I feel like they take us less seriously. I really don't know, but if you guys, if any of the listeners have a Republican candidate that they know would be willing to come onto the show, please let us know. Please email us. We'd love to have them on. Please reach out to us on our website at polititeenpodcast.com. It's just difficult to reach out to Republican candidates.
Yeah. You know, I think part of the reason, and I'm going to end this really quickly here because we have an interview coming up with Representative Brenda Lopez Romero, but part of the reason that I think that they're hard to reach out to, and not only candidates, but also Republicans on a nationwide scale, whether students or educators, I think that the reason is that they're kind of intimidated or even scared of this cancel culture that's going on in our nation, because a lot of the canceling and hatred towards parties and individuals is going towards supporters of Trump.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the times, whatever they say, no matter what it is or what evidence they have, it is overshadowed by the fact that they're supporting Trump. And it is like, you know, you support Trump, so you have no right saying this. You support Trump, so you're automatically an evil person. And even the arguments that they're making, the Democrats are just saying they're so invalid and not giving a good basis to it. I think that the reason that I think is so beneficial, because I have a lot of Republican friends that I talk to every single day with topics like these. And they've all come out to me because I'm a very open person and a person that is not a fan of the cancel culture, and I love entertaining different ideas. And so I approach everything, whether it's my family, family discussions, political discussions, with an open mind. And I am comfortable with saying that I'm sorry. And I'm comfortable with saying that I revoke my previous stance. I'm comfortable with saying that I agree with you, and I take back what I said before. And for that reason, and that reason alone, a lot of my Republican friends are like, Varun, I love speaking to you about these kinds of things because you are able to accept my standpoint and don't, you know, hate me for saying what I say. And you maybe have a different view than I do, but you accept my view and sometimes even agree with it to an extent. And that's what I love doing. You know, I love being open, and I love not just pushing somebody to the brink and not disrespecting their viewpoints, because those are their viewpoints, no matter how wrong they are. I love respecting other people's viewpoints.
Yeah, because you have to remember at the end of the day, it's all a matter of opinion and all a matter of perspective, which is why we try to have a conversation and see everyone's perspective. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen.
You cut out on my end.
Oh, okay. I think that the audio is still picking up over here. I just said that it was a matter of perspective, and that's why we love having conversations and seeing everyone's a different perspectives. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to cut to a quick message from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Representative Romero. Perfect. Okay, we're back. We're going to be joined here in a second by Representative Romero. I'm very excited, Varun, so I think we should just drag her right into the call.
Yeah, for sure.
Hello, Representative Romero. Hey, can you hear me, Varun?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Oh, awesome. There you go.
Awesome.
All right, so we're...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we're joined here by Representative Romero. If you would like to introduce yourself, Ms. Romero.
Hi. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you all, and looking forward to our conversation. I'm always excited when young folks are involved in the political process.
Absolutely. And that's great to hear. You know, our first question here at Politeam kind of to all of our interviewees comes from a very personal standpoint to a lot of them. It is, you know, we're obviously, we have ambitions of being in the political field when we grow up. So we kind of want to ask this question for our own sake. But what brought you into the field of politics from a young age? You know, what kind of inspired you to join the political field, and especially to be representative in the Georgia House of Representatives?
Well, I would say that I actually was not involved in on the political side or electoral politics, as I prefer to call it sometimes. But instead, I really, since I was in high school, started doing community service, volunteer work with nonprofits, what I consider is more advocacy work. And so I did that for about 10 or so years, working with more direct services around issues of civil rights, racial justice, immigration reform, and specifically in college, started working a lot with what is, you know, termed Dreamers, and trying to push for the Dream Act, and then eventually also supporting DACA and all other comprehensive immigration reform issues. So that is really the work that I did on the advocacy side with nonprofits. It wasn't until basically a friend told me that I should help him with a campaign that he was volunteering with, which was with the Jason Carter governor's election in 2014. That was the first time that I did anything within that sort of electoral process. And soon after that election cycle, I have had two individuals reach out to me and tell me that I should consider running for office. Well, of course, at that point, I had just graduated from law school about two or so years. I had been starting to build my own practice. So I really didn't think it was the best time for me to do that. I wanted to keep doing the practice, and then I figured that was something that I was going to do down the line. But it turns out that I had a meeting with what was then the former state representative for my district, and I tell folks the short story is that we didn't have a really good conversation. It actually he basically had very, very dismissive views and did a litany list of all the negative stereotypes of the immigrant communities that live in my district. And so our conversation ended by him telling me that I must be as bad as those people. And so wow. I got a little bit pissed off. And so ultimately, that's when I, you know, made a personal decision that, you know, I had been going to the state capitol for the last 10 years at that point, advocating on one or another issue or one or another bill, and realized that, quite frankly, vast majority of the same people that were there 10 years ago were still there that day. And if we wanted really to see a change in law, especially at the state level, we need to elect new types of people that have a different perspective about where our state is today. And that's ultimately how I first decided to run for office.
You know, I think that that's a really interesting story. And I was talking to Varun before the podcast, before we started recording, and I was telling him how close, you know, obviously you're a huge inspiration to me, being the first Latina to represent, to be a Georgia lawmaker. Me, you know, my parents being Latinos, you know, it's very inspiring to see that I can make that change, and that I can make that jump. And I didn't see how close our stories really were, but I started talking to my mom about having you on, and my mom was born in Mexico. She immigrated here, and so was her sister. They both immigrated here, her older sister, and she told me that there is a possibility that her sister and you went to high school together. So I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. Because I was telling her that you seem very familiar to me. But it's absolutely crazy to see, you know, that you're making such a great change, and you're inspiring me, and you're showing me, and you're setting up this pathway for me to follow. And I think that that's great. And I think that you bring up Dreamers and DACA is really something that I want to focus on this segment, especially. You know, Varun talked about us wanting to go into the political field. Particularly, over the past couple of months, I've been looking for an internship, and I've been wanting to go into immigration because of my father's struggles with immigration. So I wanted to talk to you about you know, the recent struggles with immigrants, especially, you know, this morning, I think Harvard and MIT sued the Trump administration over their policies about immigrants having to be in-person classes. So I wanted to ask you about your personal opinion on that.
Well, I appreciate you asking about that. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, I'm an attorney and I do primarily immigration matters. So that's, you know, really, really also my wheelhouse. And so I think it's unfortunate because this isn't just an isolated instance. We have seen this administration that attack, like was normally said before, right, that it was an issue about people that might have been here undocumented, but really has attacked access to legal migration. Numerous fronts, and this is just one of them, or an additional one in a long line that started from reducing some of the visa numbers to making it more restrictive on some of the visas that are they're even allowed for purposes. And so this is just another basically one of the last few decisions that just shows the animus that this administration generally has for people migrating or visiting, right? Because this is we're talking about student visas. And one of the things that as anybody in any college age person or anyone in college will tell you that part of the experience of college is precisely getting to know a multifaceted array of people, not only from our own state, but nationally. And of course, the international students are a large component of experience that we have while we're in college. And so I think it's really unfortunate that it takes yet another lawsuit to eventually block or have an injunction against some of these regulations that are established. And so I am glad that some of these universities have taken to sue. Other universities, for example, like Emory here in our state of Georgia, is trying to see how they can make arrangements to provide in-person classes for, you know, in the time being, if that's ultimately the requirement that prevails. So, you know, it's just one more step in the many steps that has been taken in a very negative term under this administration.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a very good point, you know, of immigration in the United States and how it's being hindered by this administration. And I guess I wanted to talk to you about tying back to your experiences as an activist, lobbying for policies to be implemented on a statewide level. By a quick look at your policies on your website, I can see that you're very against taking corporate donations for campaigns and kind of keeping a clean campaign that you know, kind of attunes to the wishes of our constituents and our people, our voters. So I guess I wanted to ask you, what is your stance on a lot of Democratic and Republican politicians taking donations from big PSCs and corporations across the nation? And do you think it's a good thing for our nation, or do you think it's a bad thing considering our political landscape right now?
Well, you know, I see it in two facets. Definitely as, you know, running for a state house, that is in a certain sense more, you know, let me start back up. And this reason why I see this as two different circumstances. One is the question is whether we should have, you know, large corporations with infinite amount of monies that are able to be placed into PACs or particularly super PACs. You know, of course, I think that that's not what we should not be doing. But there should be public finance. And so the question is, how and when do we get there? And what do we do in the meantime until we do get public finance? And that is something that, you know, that I have a lot of conversations with. Personally, I decided not to take them. It is very difficult. As a state representative, like I said, it's been, in a certain extent, I don't want to say easier, but it's been more manageable to not take super PAC money or corporate PAC money. But when I did my, I ran for Congress and in this primary election cycle, and I will tell you that it is difficult to even in a primary sense, right? When we're running, you know, when it was amongst Democrats, it's very difficult to fund your campaign without whatever funding can come in, right? And so I do have us think about that, particularly for national races at the federal level, whether sometimes we should play within the rules that are currently as they're written, right? And if other opponents are going to do the same, you know, so it's a difficult balance. And I think that it's ultimately a decision that each individual candidate has to take. I think it does make it more difficult down the line to make those changes to public to do public campaign financing if you have, you know, in the past taken corporate PAC money. So it really is a balance back and forth. And I do want to also explain the difference between super PACs, right? And and those kind of anonymity and like multi-million dollars going into different campaigns versus there are PACs, for example, that are formed that are formed to promote like a women into politics pipeline, right? Or people of color. And so those are actually technically PACs as well, right? But there is a difference between that and super PACs that are funneling multi-million dollars. I mean, most of those PACs have the same individual contribution limits, which for the purposes of Georgia, for example, it's $2,800, right? Which maybe for the everyday person, still $2,800 is a lot. But we're not talking about these multi-million dollar super PACs that are sometimes built where there's complete anonymity as to donors. And so we do have to be careful sort of when candidates do take certain PAC money that we're looking more to see what type of PAC it is. Because again, there's a huge spectrum within that entity that we call, you know, political action committees.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting that you bring up how hard it is to not run with super PACs, because we had Ted on the podcast, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Varun, but when he was running for Congress, he said that the issue was the fact that they basically ran out of money because they were running on the same platform of not taking any super PACs. And another very similar platform that both of you run on is affordable quality healthcare. So I want to know, is there a personal tie onto why you support affordable quality healthcare? Do you just believe that it's a human right?
Well, I definitely do think that healthcare access is definitely a human right. You know, that being said, so in terms of background, as we were talking about earlier, so I both of my parents are working class. I grew up on Buford Highway and went to Cross Keys for high school.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I come from a family of worker class and low income background. And so I know personally also what it means for, you know, my father to forego a standard doctor visit until the point that he eventually had to go to the emergency room to take care of something been preventive. To have his, you know, tax refund garnished to pay off those medical bills. And even, you know, without having to go through those issues that are larger, more extreme, it simply him having a ration, how much he utilizes because he's diabetic and the different supplies that he utilizes. So, you know, for me, you know, it is in terms of how I view healthcare as a human right, but it's also been a personal impact to me in my life. And so I understand how important it is for us to have that healthcare, which ultimately becomes less expensive to the taxpayer if we provide greater, more quality preventive care so that we don't have to have or deal with public issues of chronic illnesses that become a public health impact.
Yeah, and you know, part of the reason with not having healthcare that is kind of healthcare insurance for all is the fact that right now with the COVID-19 situation, hospitals are going bankrupt, you know, because they can't pay for these out-of-pocket patients who can't pay for their own insurance or the treatment. And so a lot of hospitals in Georgia and across the nation, correct me if I'm wrong, Damien, are going bankrupt because of the fact that patients don't have insurance who are going to these hospitals and getting treated for COVID. So it's an important point that you bring up, talking about insurance and Medicare for all, because I'm a strong believer in that. You know, we're both strong believers in that on the podcast today. But talking about some hard choices, Representative, that you're going to have to take in our nation, and a lot of Democrats and Republicans are going to have to take in our nation in the coming decades and coming years, I wanted to bring up one of your main policies on your website that you mentioned, and that is, environmental equity, you know, climate change reform. And I think that, you know, it's a hard choice for a lot of people in today's climate. It should be a hard choice, but it is a hard choice for a lot of people to decide whether we need to put money and resources towards clean energy and green energy. So what is your standpoint on how we can, first of all, create environmental equity in our nation, in our state and local areas? And second of all, how we can kind of shift the tide towards how people think about the environment and climate change, and make people kind of see the issues and accept these issues and make that hard choice, as you're saying?
Well, I would say that what's important, particularly for states like ours, like in Georgia, is that you have to have a conversation, and the message has to shift, quite frankly, a little bit away from just simply, you know, we're trying to save our planet, to like what that means for Georgia, both in environmental sense, but also in economic impact, right? And I think that resonates a lot. And I will tell you, last legislative session before this year, with COVID issues, there was actually several bills that were moved forward by Republican legislators. One of it was a conservation trust. It was a constitutional amendment that eventually passed on our ballot, November ballot of 2018, yes. And basically, it was to be able to earmark certain money to go to the conservation of certain public lands, public state parks, for example. And the reason we need to do that is that any tax revenue that is brought into the state goes into a general fund, and you can't really earmark it for anything unless it's so written in the Constitution. So that moved forward and passed. And also, there was another piece of legislation that helped with protecting the barrier reefs in our coastal area of our state. And these were all Republican sponsored, and ultimately because the Republicans are the political majority in our state legislature, those bills can't pass without them. And so they did pass. And one of the reasons that they were brought forward by those representatives is that they represent those areas, and they're starting to see their towns feeling an impact from different issues of climate change. And so I think that having those conversations about how it's affected us and how it's going to continue to affect us here locally in our homes and in our pocketbooks, key example also, last legislative session we had to go back to special session to provide state emergency fundings after just one hurricane, Hurricane Michael, that devastated the southwest portions of Georgia. And farmers there are still trying to recover from loss of crop that whole season. So, you know, I think that that's the conversation we need to have in our local communities on the economic impact side and how it's affecting literally our homes, but also have the conversation about how this can also be, you know, a way that communities, especially those communities that might otherwise not have the diversity and profile of jobs that somewhere like Metro Atlanta might have, can veer into clean energy industries, right? That are high paying jobs. South Georgia, particularly farmland, is a good example. In Dalton as well, we have two solar energy companies that are Georgia grown. And Georgia manufactured, that are also leasing land from farmers to be able to utilize for solar panels. And so I think that that's right. Where our conversation needs to go when we're talking to individuals here.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, you bring up the different job opportunities and stuff that can come with switching to something better for the environment, obviously. And something that ties into that is your strong platform on good jobs and economic growth. So I kind of wanted to tie that into the financial literacy kind of epidemic that we're facing in our minority communities. So what do you think is the solution to create communities that don't suffer from the financial illiteracy that we're seeing a lot of our local communities suffer from?
Well, I would say that, you know, this is an issue that has to be addressed across different ways. So, for example, there has been legislation introduced to provide a financial literacy course as a requirement in our high schools. And unfortunately, you would think that, you know, is straightforward, makes sense. And there really wasn't so much pushback either from the teachers, because there's always sometimes pushback when there's mandated classes, because as we know, in school, we already have our schedule so tight with all of the mandates about different classes that need to be taken and different criteria that needs to be taught. And so, you know, for starters, I think we need that education to be more straightforward in our curriculum, probably starting as early as really, quite frankly, is middle school and high school. And also, you know, that's on one end, right? You can teach it, but you can teach a class, but ultimately that doesn't mean that especially when we're young, that we're going to understand how valuable that's going to be, how valuable that class might be into our future. So I think that also working in conjunction with nonprofits, Junior Achievement, for example, comes to mind, that provides some of that age-appropriate curriculum on financial literacy, and making sure that, you know, organizations like Junior Achievement, you know, reaches out to all communities, particularly if there is, like you mentioned, a community or area that we can see has a greater need for that financial literacy. I think that we need to do the conjunction of both, again, that from the nonprofit side, bringing in those extracurricular kind of activities and camps that they have, in conjunction with improving our school curriculum on that topic.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about the same topic with one of our previous guests, Dr. Ronald Mason from University of DC. And he kind of mentioned how, you know, a lot of Black people have this kind of unsecured debt that they can't kind of account for without the proper financial literacy. And that's the main gap between Black communities and white communities in our nation. And even what you say about healthcare pertains to that. You know, we have higher healthcare costs in Black communities as compared to white communities in these poorer communities, which is simply not fair, I believe. But talking about not fair and talking about equal opportunities for all, as we see on your website, I'm looking at how you think that it's fair to prevent mass incarceration of nonviolent offenders. And that's something I and Damian both agree with, as we said it before on previous podcasts. But I wanted to gauge upon that point, how do you feel about the privatization of prisons? Because one of the main issues that we've tackled on the podcast is how we're kind of reinstating the slave labor system with having these offenders put in prisons for so long periods of time for nonviolent crimes and working on kind of plantations for privatization, private prisons. So how do you feel about that whole process?
Well, I definitely do not agree that there should be privatizations of any detention centers. That includes immigration detention centers, which are also held by two large private prison industries. And so, you know, that is very problematic when anyone is when there's a profit incentive to detain people. And we've seen that study after study when some of these large complexes, particularly when they're built, you know, when new ones are built, it just so happens that incarceration goes up in and around that community and in its surrounding area. So absolutely, I definitely agree with y'all in the aspect that there should be no incentive of profit while detaining people. And so that is on that end that you're talking about, making sure that we don't incentivize through private contracts the incarceration of people. But of course, you know, quite frankly, I think the vast majority of what we have to work on and why local elections matter are who are our DAs, right? And making sure that we are having DAs that, yes, are going to help, you know, protect us in public safety sense, particularly, you know, amongst egregious violent crime, but also understand, you know, or have a philosophy that the judicial system or the legal system has to have some sort of rehabilitative aspect to it, and not just a retribution or punishment aspect. And so, you know, so who are our DAs are very important. Who's running to be our DAs is solely important. And typical races that we sometimes, you know, aren't as excited or aren't, you know, are going out to vote as frequently as we should. For example, here in Gwinnett County, we have a runoff for our DA on the Democratic ticket side, that whoever the Democratic primary nominee is going to be, will be running in November in the general election against a Republican DA that has been there for 20 plus years. And so, yeah, you know, these are the races that we really need to take a look at. You know, they're not as exciting, they're not as glamorous, I would say, unfortunately, especially in terms of media limelight, but they're so, so important to the issues of being able to reform our legal system. So again, so it's less about, or it's not solely about retribution, and it starts becoming rehabilitating.
Yeah, no, and you talk about how they're not interesting races. And I think in America, we've kind of taken this stance where federal politics is what matters the most. And if you don't vote federal, you know, everything's going to come crashing down. But I think that we really need to focus on local elections. And that's what really affects 90% of our daily lives. So it's amazing that you bring that up. But speaking of the difference between federal and local, obviously, you know, since Trump announced his campaign, there's, you know, we mentioned it earlier on the podcast, there's been, you know, slanderous lies about the Hispanic community. You know, I'm sure that as you have had to face some of the backlash from his statements. And it's unfortunate, but I've been dying to have someone on the podcast that can really explain the importance of immigrants, and not only Hispanic immigrants, but, you know, all Dreamers and anyone, you know, that really can be eligible for DACA. I want to know, I guess, for our viewers, what is the importance of these immigrants?
Well, you know, for me, of course, this is really personal. I was also born in Mexico, and so I came here when I was 5 years old. My father was already here, so first me and my mom came to reunite with him. And so had it not been for Ronald Reagan signing the amnesty in the mid-80s, my father wouldn't have been able to have an option to become green card holder, eventually apply for me and my family, or, you know, my siblings and mom, and then eventually have the ability for myself to become a citizen down the line. And so for me, it's really hard to not understand it from that personal perspective, where despite the fact of being foreign born, culturally, all of my education has been here in the States. All of my professional interests and desires to work is to better our, well, particularly our state here in Georgia, since this is also where I grew up. And quite frankly, vast majority, particularly of young folks that, you know, call the United States home because that's the only home they've ever known, all they ever want to do is kind of provide their talents, their assets, their aspirations, whatever those might be, whether it's the legal world, whether it's being a doctor, you know, whether it's going into nursing, that, you know, they want to provide that value back to their communities, back to their cities, back to their states. And so that has been really the engine that has continuously reinvigorated, I would say, this country, as new waves of people with quite frankly, new vigor, right? New vigor to work hard, and to give back, you know, sort of as a sentiment of appreciation for the opportunities that are given, despite the barriers, despite the obstacles, the discrimination that one faces. Even with all of that calculated in, people are still willing to provide, you know, all of their blood, sweat, and tears to make sure that they prosper, and in that prosperity, making sure that this country continues to prosper as well. And so, you know, that's ultimately the intrinsic value that all waves of immigrants have done. That is obviously from Chinese that helped build our railroads, that were excluded for citizenship at some point. That goes back to even white immigrants, right? That initially were not considered white, and that's Irish individuals of Irish background were also discriminated at, in their heyday of arriving to this country.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's unfortunately a cycle that we see far too often, where at some point the critical mass of new individuals, or what are considered new individuals, instead of us initially integrating them, there is some onset of backlash. But eventually, as we keep doing this work, I think little at a time things improve. But that doesn't mean that there's not ever room for more improvement.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you know, you were mentioning the kind of the backlash that immigrants heavily face. You know, I mentioned on the podcast before, and I have no issue mentioning it. You know, I've seen my dad arrested when trying to get his driver's license to keep providing for my family, and I've seen ICE show up and bring these shackles that almost, you know, look like shackles for animals, really. And you know, not he didn't have any warrants out for his arrest, he didn't have anything, he was simply trying to get his license, and he faced that. And even so, he and I both consider this country our country. And in asking Dr. Mason the question that I'm about to ask you, he said a quote that resonated with me heavily, and he said, "I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." And, you know, that's a quote from James Baldwin. So with that being said, I want to ask you, if you had one quote, one saying, one message that you could leave to America's youth, what would it be?
Oh, wow. Well, I will tell you that, especially for young folks, one of the quotes, and I don't know that I'm quoting it directly, more of a paraphrase, you know, but and that ties in normally when I'm asked about, you know, what is my definition of success and things along those lines. And quite frankly, for me, and I think that what we must always strive for, particularly as it relates to continuing to provide for greater justice, greater equity, for everyone here in this country. And I think that that's an ongoing thing that we will always have to aspire to, because we're imperfect, we're human. And so I think that there's never a time where we're not going to aspire for something better. And we should, because at that point, if we stop doing that, then, you know, we're no longer growing. And so for me, the quote would go around, you know, related to that, success is, you know, it was sort of like success is failing, you know, 9 times and making sure that you get up and try that 10th time yet again. And so if we're perpetually doing that, I think that we, you know, we're always going to be moving the needle forward, even if it's slow, and even if it's frustrating for us as we do it, and even though sometimes it's very tiresome to do, but it's necessary. Because the moment we don't get back up on that horse is when we've actually failed.
Yeah. You know, it's very powerful, you saying, you know, fail 9 times and try again the 10th time, because that's what makes the American spirit. You know, and from my 15 years in America, being a student, I have understood that about our nation and the people that live within it. We have a resolve, no matter who it is, Republicans or Democrats, we have a resolve to continue past our breaking point and to become, you know, a better nation beyond anything. And that's the reason why we started this podcast, to kind of, you know, begin that conversation and to make bridge the door and bridge the gap towards having that discussion and trying again that 10th time, no matter how much backlash we receive for our actions. But that said, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast. You know, I think I speak for Damien in saying that it was an amazing show, an amazing interview with you. And we'd love to have you on sometime else if you'd be down for it.
Absolutely. Anytime. And especially once session starts back up next January. It doesn't have to be until then, but definitely would love to come back and kind of talk about what's happening in what legislation is moving forward in the state legislature. That's always fun for us to know. And so I appreciate you for having me, and I'm really easy to get a hold of, find, see, you know, some kind of sort of what my next plans and next challenges are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram. My handle is the same, Vote Brenda Lopez, and please feel free, anybody, to reach me out there for any questions you might have. I'll try to answer them as best as I can.
Yeah, and with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure to have a good rest of your evening. Good night.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politeteen Podcast. As always, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politeteen Show, or to, you know, send us an email at politeteenpodcast@gmail.com to connect with our initiative. And lastly, as always, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our research director at Julia Harmon for inspiring the wonderful content that we present day after day, and to our graphic design director and Jada Pilling for the graphics that illuminate our segments. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your days.